You are listening to WIOX Roxbury, community radio at 91.3 FM, WIOXradio.org, and on your smart device.
WIOX is supported by Mountain Flame in Arkville, featuring a range of products for home heating solutions. A variety of fireplaces, wood stoves, and gas and pellet stoves are available and on display. For sales and service, Mountain Flame in Arkville, warming home since 1980. Details at mountainflame.com.
WIOX is supported by the United Way of Delaware and Otsego Counties, with local programs designed to improve health, education, and income security in our communities, including the Volunteer Generation Fund, matching volunteers with local agencies fighting hunger and emergency food and shelter services. More information at 607-432-8006 or unitedwaydo.org.
You're listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and on MTC Cable Channel 20 and at WIOXradio.org on the web and on any smart device. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. And, well, it is the season of the hunting season. And I guess winter has come early this year. And I will just say before we get into tonight's show, which will be reading The Forested Landscape with professor and author Tom Wessels. I was hunting over near Ulster County in about the town of Gardner or so. And there was definitely more bear sign than I have ever seen in my life this year. Probably crossed about a dozen bear tracks, so I guess the Walk Hill and the Rondout Valley are definitely on the cusp of a higher bear population, and which makes sense, I guess. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they're moving from the Catskills or from New Jersey. Who knows? But how's it going, John?
Oh, it's going well, Ryan. I've been all over these Catskill Mountains, up in the hills this last week.
Yeah.
Yep. I'm sure you mentioned it's rifle season out there, and I've been chasing the almighty whitetail deer.
Yeah. And how'd that go?
Pretty successful.
Nice.
I did. I got a nice buck, and I saw several other deer and helped a few other friends get their deer, and it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah?
I got to see a bunch of things along the way, some rough grouse, snowshoe hare the other day. That was pretty unique. I've one of the closest hares I've ever walked up on, maybe 6 or 8 feet away from me.
Really?
Yeah, before it flushed. And, you know, I could have probably even gotten closer, but I didn't even think I was going to walk up on it. I walked up on all these tracks, in the back of my head, I'm thinking, man, that hare's got to be right here. Then I jump over a ledge rock to get down. I was heading down off the side of the mountain. I jump off the side of the ledge rock, and he was right there at the base of it.
Oh, yeah.
I jumped right next to him. So had I thought a little harder about him being so close, I probably could have got a better view of him, but I saw him run.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, I assume he's white.
White, a little bit of gray in this one.
Yeah.
But he was more gray than the snow was. It was a fresh snow. And he ran. He's big. It's mostly fur, but they look to be almost the size of a basketball when they're running away from you.
And did you see any bear tracks? Because I saw a ton where I was hunting.
Yep. I saw one set of bear tracks on, I think it was, let's see here. It would have been Friday or Saturday of last week. And I think they were probably 3 or 4 days older than that. So maybe they would have walked through right around Wednesday. They had some snow in them, but they covered some distance. I traveled with the bear, followed his tracks, and then I was working the ridge top and ran into his tracks again, and then dropped down off the ridge and ran into his tracks again. So I figured between where I started and where I saw his last track, it was over 2 miles apart.
Yeah.
So he was on the move somewhere.
Well, did you make contact with our potential guest here, Tom Wessels?
Voicemail.
All right, so we'll see if we can get Tom Wessels on. He's calling in from University of New Hampshire over there in Antioch. I don't know how to say that. Antioch University. And, he's a terrestrial ecologist and professor emeritus. Also wrote a really good book that I read a few years back called Reading the Forested Landscape. And hopefully we can talk about that. And it's really something cool to do. You can just go out in the woods and you can kind of tell by looking at the trees and obviously stone walls, stuff like that, the lay of the land, and, kind of tell what's going on in the past.
Well, most of the trees in our forests and our Catskill Mountains have not been planted. They've all sprouted on their own, and based on the forest history or the land use history before that, it really might dictate what tree sprouted there and why, or forest succession might tell you that as well, but you could really piece together a puzzle of really hundreds of years before where you're standing and figure out what might have gone on. It's pretty neat.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if he coined this term originally, but he calls it forest forensics. So, we'll see if we can get him on. We'll reach out to Tom Wessels here from Antioch University over there in New Hampshire. Alright, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. with Ryan and John. Talk about a different forest-related topic. Tonight's topic is Reading the Forested Landscape with professor and author Tom Wessels. He wrote the book Reading the Forested Landscape and A History of New England. We can't get Tom right now. He must be up there in New Hampshire. Hopefully everything's all right. But I've read the book, and I use it, practically speaking, when I'm not on WIOX and walking people's land for Catskill Forest Association. So I've used a lot from what I've learned from this book. And also I've taken a woods walk with Tom Wessels when he came to Delhi. I don't remember when, 2010 maybe. And so, yeah, let's go through it. Let's go through what this Reading the Forested Landscape is, forest forensics. Tom Wessels, he calls, first of all, we'll start with stone walls, right? And agriculture being probably one of the most significant land use influences in our forest. And he calls stone walls the eighth wonder of the world.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, there's not a lot of written history about the walls that I know of, is there?
Well, he says that if they were put all together, they would be, oh, God, they'd be way larger than all the pyramids put together. I forget how many thousands of miles they would come to, but it was quite shocking. And at the same time, it's not so shocking. I mean, I think, anecdotally speaking, the place that has more stone walls than anywhere in the Catskills, and they all have a lot, you know, I'm not saying, like, you know, they don't. But you've seen down by Accord, between Accord and Sampsonville, that town of Rochester area, I think there's more friggin'...
I always wonder what's going on.
Mile.
I want to know what's going on or what went on, what they farmed or what happened there, because most of the rest of the Catskills, you find stone walls that are one layer wide, so they're 18, 20 inches wide, 24 maybe, and maybe waist high at the tallest. Most of them string around somewhere between 10 and 20 acre fields, what would have been fields, and or sometimes smaller, but this area, they've unbelievable. They're thick. I'm talking 8, 12, 14 feet wide in some spots, and they're dense. So their area is like quarter acre or half acre large. It's weird.
Well, from reading his book, I can't prove this really, but there's a couple of reasons why I think there's a lot of stone walls per square mile there. And one is that those farms predate rail. So before the Civil War, in the Catskill Mountains, you don't have railroad.
Okay.
Okay? So they're mostly sheep farms. It wasn't until railroad came in, according to Wessels, where you start getting dairy farms. Now you can ship milk to New York City. Okay? But before then, it's mostly sheep farms. Because there's no rail, people were growing their own grains. Okay? So these farms date back to the 1700s. In some cases, probably the 1600s in the Rondout Valley. Right? It's also really poor land. But whereas in Delaware County, by the time the farms really got going up here, which was later, rail was already in here. And it's not to say they weren't growing any grains. They just weren't growing as many grains. And he would say probably they're being imported on rail. So how does that affect stone walls?
I'm wondering. I don't...
Right. So stone walls here in Delaware County, I think it's a big misconception that you'll hear people in Delaware County say that they have nice square walls and the ones in Ulster are not. They have rounder rocks. It's actually because there's different land uses. So because they're importing their grains, there's less plowing going on in Delaware County, and the walls were only used to hold in cows.
Right.
So you're just digging for square rocks, flat rocks to make walls. All right. But when you're plowing, rocks actually grow to the surface through winter. They're heaved up.
Right.
And those little rocks. Yeah, about fist size come to the surface, and you're just throwing round size rocks to the side if you're plowing for corn or rye or buckwheat when you're growing your own grains. Buckwheat and rye grow in poor soil. In fact, they need poor soil in order to stand. And so they don't rot or something. I was reading about it. But in any case, yeah, you're just throwing those rocks. And I believe this because in my own yard was a plow field. It's not a square rock wall on the side of my property. Instead, it's a rock wall where they just threw the rocks. So, you know, they'd rise to the top, and I've since found it was grown for potatoes. And when they plow, it comes to the surface, and they keep throwing them to the side. So you get these really wide, massive walls that are literally like 6 feet across, sometimes eight. They might build one side and then the other side with square rocks and then just fill in the center. You see a lot of that towards the Rondout Valley. And
I've seen that with a big pile of rocks in the center of a field.
You see in Delaware County where, you, especially on a big bouldery area, they'll just dump
just
rocks.
Pile on a boulder, yeah.
But they weren't doing it as much. Not to say they weren't. They were doing it. Cauliflower and stuff like that where they were plowing. But you just see more of it in those older farmed areas. Also, I think there was more small farms in that area of Accord to Sampsonville because they were really poor. I mean, you don't have the big springs like you do in the big mountains of Delaware County where you have better springs and you can have larger farms, I think. So I don't know. That's just my idea.
Well,
so,
it makes total sense. I mean, the walls would get bigger the longer it's been farmed, the more rocks could accumulate by sealing it up. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so if you're standing somewhere in Delaware County or Ulster County or whatever, and it's smooth, it's really abnormally smooth, and you look to the side, instead of a square wall, you see a really wide wall with round rocks. It is probably a plow field. They're plowing the ground. If you just see a square wall, it's probably just pasture then for animals. So that's kind of cool to think about.
Yeah. So also, in my experience working and walking with landowners in their woods, a lot of people don't realize the extent of farmland reach. A lot of people don't realize that where I'm taking them up in the woods, that they're once walking in an old field. And it really takes some explaining. And basically, the easiest way to explain is to point to the wall and said, well, we're standing next to a stone wall in the middle of the woods here, but no farmer put his animals in the woods, not to any large extent. So, no. Yeah, it proves there was a hay field right here. So where'd the trees come from?
Right. Yeah. No, almost no trees are planted that you see today. One thing I just want to hit upon real quick. The reason why rocks kind of rise to the top when you're plowing in a field as opposed to in the woods is because, and I didn't understand this till reading this book, but there's no tree roots. So there's nothing to keep down the rocks. And through frost heaving and stuff, they actually come to the surface because there's no big tree roots. I didn't understand that, but it makes sense.
Well, yeah, and it's the same thing in a stream too. So if you look at the composition of that stream, you'll see mostly larger rocks on the surface, and then all that sand and silt sediment kind of flows between them and settles between them. You put a bunch of dirt in a cup and you shake it up real hard and then let it settle back out, you're going to have all the fine stuff at the bottom, the medium stuff in the middle, and the coarse stuff on the top. It's just the way things arrange themselves over time and after disturbance. That's how you get a hard pan.
Yeah.
A lot of times a hard pan, and people talk about hard pans, what that is the clay material separating out of the soil. A lot of times you'll find it at 18 to 24 inches deep because that's how deep plows have been plowing it for 100 years, and over time all that clay drops out towards the bottom and you get more of the coarser soils on top.
Yeah, I could say mine's about 24 to 36 inches.
There you go. Taking a lot of holes in your yard?
Yes, I have. One thing more about agriculture is that, you know, before rail came in, like I said, it was a lot of sheep. And Tom Wessels in his book, Reading the Forest of the Landscape, he talks about that. And it's mostly from a New England perspective, but I'm sure there's some similarities in New York State. I guess there was the Spanish had the lock on the market of merino wool. But somehow it was smuggled into the New World. And once that happened, pasture for sheep went insane. And he calls it a sheep fever mania. So, you know, before sheep fever mania, which is in, I guess, the 1800s, early 1800s, you know, you have like 80% forested, and then it goes to 20% forested.
Wow.
In New England. And I'm sure it's similar in New York. Pretty crazy. So, yeah, I know in New York State, you know, we're at, you know, what, 20% forest by the late 1800s. That's when it peaked, sometime in the late 1800s, depending on where you are. So, yeah. So, pasture, again, if you got some square rocks, just square walls on the side, it's probably used for pasture. And if you're you're standing on some smooth surface with round rocks or a big rock dump somewhere, it was probably cropped, which means it was plowed. So, all right. And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is reading the forested landscape. Our guest is supposed to be Tom Wessels from Antioch University over there in New Hampshire. But we're just going to go ahead and do the show. So, evidence of wind damage. This is kind of cool, actually. Pit and mound. You ever be walking in the woods, especially on forest preserve land, and there's just weird little pits, you know, depressions followed by mounds on the other sides. You must have seen that.
Sure. I see it all the time.
Yeah. And what these are is it's basically a windstorm of an ancient tree that went down, and it excavates as the root ball goes up. There's an excavation, and then as that root ball basically rots down and decomposes, it creates a mound.
Okay, yeah, sure. All that soil is bound up in the roots, and when the roots rot away, they got a pile of dirt.
These things can last hundreds of years, all right? And what's even really cool is if you stand on, you know, the mound, you can visualize where the trunk was. Right? And if you face that direction, you can tell where the wind came from.
Right.
So it typically, not always, but generally speaking, if you can tell the tree went down, you know, towards the east, that means there was a west wind. Usually, according to Tom Wessels, it's a thunderstorm during that time period. If it came from, if it's facing northwest or something, the storm probably came from the southeast. Maybe it's a hurricane. And he's actually traced these events back in Vermont and New Hampshire, where you can actually trace it back to a specific time and date hurricane struck that area.
That makes a lot of sense.
Or a nor'easter comes around.
I was going to say, or if it's facing south, it could have been a nor'easter pushing wind out of the north.
Yeah, so these pit and mounds can be very helpful. It's pretty neat stuff.
Huh.
So
I'm gonna look at that next time I see one. I've never thought about that.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty cool. So, you're just tuning in. You're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is reading the forested landscape. And up next, we'll talk more about pit and mounds, agriculture, and some more impacts from the Civil War.
Life's tough, and then you die, and there ain't no rhyme or reason why. Try to choose, see you do what you do. Love's great until it's not, hearts break. But the world don't stop when it rains, man, it pours. You can't change the course, you can wish on a star. But if it ain't in the cards, let it go. Sometimes you gotta let it go. Landing on wash on under the bridge. Cause it is what it is, time flies. While you save it all up, but someday this'll all be dust. It's all just stuff, it ain't never enough. And you can't take it with you, so you might as well just let it go. Yeah, you really ought to let it go. Let it all wash on under the bridge. Blow it a kiss, give it a rest, cause it is what it is, you never know what's waiting just up the road. Sooner or later that sun's gonna shine, luck will turn on a dime. So when the good times roll, let them roll, but when they don't, let it go. Move on, keep moving till you see the light. in the night, saying, hey there, friend, where the hell have you been? Let it go. You really gotta let it go. Let it all wash on under the breeze. Blow it a kiss and give it a rest, 'cause it is what it is. You never know what's waiting just up the road. Sooner or later that sun's gonna shine. Lucky turn on a dime, and when the good times roll, let them roll. Let it go. You really gotta let it go. Let it go. Sometimes you gotta let it go. Let it go. You really ought to let it go.
Let it go. All right, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest, every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. Tonight's topic is reading the forested landscape. Our guest was supposed to be Tom Wessels from Antioch University in New Hampshire, but we can't find Tom. That's okay. So we were just talking about pit and mound topography. Maybe you're walking in the woods and you see these odd-shaped little pits followed by mounds, and that represents wind damage from trees that blew over many decades, sometimes centuries ago. So how do you age these things? How do you age when farm abandonment occurred or a pit and mound? And according to Tom Wessels' book, Reading the Forested Landscape, there's a couple ways. So farm abandonment, you know, a lot of times there's this tree that grows in abandoned farms. And it's called old field pine is one common name. Another common name is white pine, Pinus strobus.
Wolf pine.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, if you see white pine growing and it has like multi-liter, that probably indicates it grew up in the middle of a field with abundant sunshine, because a little insect called a white pine weevil kills the terminal leader in conditions where there's a lot of light. White pine that grow in the shade will grow more straight and they don't succumb to that white pine weevil damage. Okay, that's one thing to take note of. But how do you age using a white pine? You look at the whorls, man. There's branches of a white pine grow in a series of whorls, meaning the branches grow in whorls, and then you go up and you just count the whorls, and it's very easy. So, you know, next time you're on the side of the road, you see a white pine, you'll see like rings of branches or whorls, and you can pretty much pinpoint when that tree was started to grow.
Yeah, within a few years. So every year there's a new set of whorls.
Yeah.
Usually 18 inches to 3 feet apart, depending on how fast it grew that year.
Yeah, absolutely. So then there's another So say you have pit and mound. You want to know when that pit and mound was created? It's not an exact science, because trees don't usually start growing on a mound of a decomposed root ball right away. But a lot of times you'll see like a white birch tree growing on these mounds of the pit and mound topography. Diameter is not always the best indicator of age, but white birch, being a shade-intolerant tree, is pretty uniform in its growth rate, all right, because it grows in the open sunlight. So typically speaking, you know, a 12-inch or 1-foot diameter white birch tree is about 50 years in age. A 2-foot diameter white birch tree is about 100 years. So there you go. You see a, you know, a foot diameter, 12-inch diameter white birch tree, it's probably about 50 years old. So you know that that tree started to grow on that mound 50 years ago, plus or minus. You know, you probably add a few, because it takes a while for birch to germinate.
What if it's not a white birch? We don't know that.
I guess, black birch, I'm not so sure you can do that with.
Yeah, I see black birch and yellow birch do that as well, but they're shade-tolerant trees, so their growth rates are going to be variable extremely depending on the sunlight.
Yep, I agree. I don't think so. But he talks about the Civil War a lot, he meaning Tom Wessels, in his book Reading the Forested Landscape. And we were just talking about this earlier today at the office, but the Civil War, you know, is what, maybe the bloodiest war. It was the bloodiest war in American history. And to this day, you can see impacts of it in the forest. But basically, you have a huge amount of farm abandonment that occurs in the forest. And we're going to take a break real quick, see if we can get Mr. Wessels on the air. And if you're just tuning in, tonight's topic is Reading the Forested Landscape with professor and author Tom Wessels from Antioch University. We can't get him yet, but hopefully we can.
There was a time in this fair land when the railroad did not run, when the wild majestic mountains stood alone against the sun. Long before the white man and long before the wheel, when the green dark forest was too silent to be real. But time has no beginnings and the history has no bounds. As to this verdant country, they came from all around. They sailed upon her waterways and they walked the forest tall. Built the mines, the mills, and the factories for the good of us all. And when the young man's fancy had turned into the spring, the railroad men grew restless for to hear the hammers ring. Their minds were overflowing with the visions of their day, with many a fortune won and lost and many a debt to pay. For they looked in the future and wanted to see this on iron road running from the sea to the sea, bringing the goods to a young growing land, all up from the seaboards and into their hands. Look away, said they, across this mighty land, from the eastern shore to the western strand. Bring the workers and bring up the rails. We gotta lay down the tracks and tear up the trails. Open your heart, let the lifeblood flow. Gotta get on our way, cause we're moving too slow. Bring in the workers and bring up the rails. We gotta lay down the tracks and tear up the trails. Open your heart, let the lifeblood flow. Gotta get on our way, cause we're moving too slow. Get on our way, cause we're moving too slow. Across the white prairie, our loved ones lie sleeping. Beyond the dark oceans, in a place far away, we are the navvies who work upon the railway, swinging our hammers in the bright blazing sun, living on stew and drinking bad whiskey, mending our backs till the long days are done. We are the navvies who work upon the railway, swinging our hammers in the bright blazing sun.
song. Laying down track and building the bridges. Bending our back, still the railroad. Swinging our hammers and drawing up pay, driving them in and tying them down, away to the bunkhouse and into the town. A dollar a day and a place for my head, a drink to the living, a toast to the dead. Oh, the song of the future has been sung.
WIOX is supported by Willow Dre Farm in Andes, an open pastoral setting for year-round corporate events, artistic retreats, and weddings, pondside ceremonies, an 1,800-square-foot reception pavilion, and meadows for up to 300 guests, set among rolling hills and mountain views. More details about the facilities and nearby accommodations for overnight guests at willowdrefarm.com, Willow, D-R-E-Y, Farm. WIOX is supported by Rick's Tire Service, family-owned and operated on State Route 30 between Roxbury and Grand Gorge. Tires, mounting, and wheel balancing for cars, trucks, lawn, garden, farm, and construction vehicles. Open Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, Saturday, 8 till noon. More information at 800-LG-TIRES, 800-LG-TIRES.
This is From the Forest, every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is reading the forested landscape. Our guest is supposed to be Tom Wessels, but we're going to have to get Tom some other time. So reading the forested landscape, a lot of this information is based off of Tom Wessels' book, Reading the Forested Landscape. Civil War, John. Big deal in the forest. I've been hiking on Forest Preserve, 5-6 years ago, and there was some red oaks that came down over the trail, and the trail crew had, you know, cut them up, and I could count the rings on them, and they were about, you know, 150 or so years old, dating back to almost Civil War, and there was definitely a farm there because there was a known grist mill in this area. Believe it or not, it's in the middle of the woods now, but back in the day, that was an actual road that people used connecting two hamlets. And it was a big deal to have a granary because you could grind up flour.
Right.
And a lot of these millstones came from the Shawangunk Ridge, made from Shawangunk conglomerate. So they had millstone access from that area, and they hoisted the – they moved these millstones all over the country, actually. But this one was town of Rochester, and I actually read about it. They were grinding up white flour. I know people don't like white flour today, but white flour back then was a luxury. So, but Civil War occurs, and a lot of men don't come home. A lot of men take jobs in the cities, move to Poughkeepsie, you move to Walden, you move to Middletown, you move to Sydney.
A lot of them didn't make it to come home at all.
You just didn't move. You didn't make it home. Or, you know, or you're injured, maimed, whatnot. So, you know, it's pretty crazy stuff. So there's a lot of farm abandonment that occurs, especially on what is called the hill farms. Or scratch farms, you know. Scratch farms are those real hard scrabble areas where, you know, they're usually subsistence farms to begin with. Their main occupation was farmer, but they did a lot of things. Maybe they did charcoal burning. They sold charcoal, wood charcoal around the country. They hoop shaving, right, for wooden barrels used to be tied together not by metal but with wooden hoops. So that was a huge thing. Ulster County is one of the biggest areas of hoops in the world. You picked some ginseng, you hunted, maybe served as a hunting guide once the mountain resorts came, mountain hotels.
Yep.
And farming was your main thing, but there was a lot of things, jack of all kind of trades. But, yeah, Civil War happens, and huge farm abandonment, right? 1860s, 1880s, the farm starts growing back. 1930s to 1950s, that's when your hunting club begins, you know, and that's when people start hunting the big deer in the big woods because that's where those hill farms were, you know.
So you're saying 50 years after that peak farm abandonment of Civil War is the good hunting.
Yeah, it created really ripe conditions for the almighty white-tailed deer to come back.
That's right.
That's right, the almighty buck. So there you go. So, okay, evidence of logging and stumps. So the first half of the show is evidence of agriculture. We talked about pit mounds and how they indicate wind damage. Let's talk about logging and stumps. I mean, we see a lot of logging in the forest, right?
Yep.
So basal scars. You ever be walking in the woods and you see some scars on trees? This one's an obvious one, right? If you see scars on one side of the tree facing you and on the other side is another one facing you, it means it's probably a skid road, right?
That's right. If they're about 12 feet apart and there's two scars facing each other, a hitch of logs went through there.
Yeah.
Pulled by a log skidder or a bulldozer or something and scuffed up the trees.
But here's something you might not have known, John.
I don't know.
All right. So, I read this years ago when I read Tom Wessel's book, Reading the Forested Landscape, but studying for this show, I had forgotten it. I realized I'd forgotten it. So, you can tell when that logging occurred. If you count the rings on the callus or the wound wood from that basal scar,
then
so
it back,
trees will form wound wood or a callus material. I know the official term now is called wound wood. I don't want to upset any arborists. But on the side of that wound, and there'll be rings. And you count those rings, and that's how long.
It's called a cat face, too, right?
Cat face, yes, I guess. I don't know.
I guess when it heals up, it starts to swell together and looks more like a cat face over time. I don't know. Yes. Never seen it myself, but.
Well, just look on the side of that open wound where the log had, you know, butted against the tree and wounded it. Count the rings of the wound wood, and, you know, maybe you'll see 13, 14, 25, 30 of them.
Well, how do you count those rings without cutting the tree down, though?
You'll see in the wound wood itself.
You'll see, okay,
some rings.
I'll have to pay attention next time.
I'm sure some trees are easier than others in counting, too, right?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and that's going to be a wound that you'll see in the tree, even if that tissue meets back up. You'll still see that scarring.
Yeah.
So it could be 50 years old and 50 years later and still be seen.
Yeah. It's pretty neat.
Nice.
Stumps. Now, Dr. Michael Kudish, who wrote the book, A History of the Catskill Forest, we've had him on, and he is a stump expert. So I'm not going to even try to compete with Mr. Kudish. But Mr. Wessels here wrote the book, Reading the Forest of Landscape, talks about stumps and some pretty cool things he goes into. So conifers. How can you tell if it was a conifer stump? You see a stump, you wonder what it is, right? Conifers usually rot from the outside in. All right. Outside in, remember that. Conifers, outside in. We're usually talking about, in our area, hemlock and white pine.
Okay.
Okay, outside in. Typically, white pine, according to Mr. Wessels, rots in about 25 years. So, okay, 25 years. Now, something special about white pine over hemlock is that white pine normally becomes very moss-covered. Extremely, that's not a word, very moss-covered. Extremely moss-covered, okay? And when it becomes moss-covered, it becomes an excellent nurse stump. And if it's a log, a nurse log, for yellow birch or hemlock to grow upon. You've seen this before.
All the time. You ever see a yellow birch that grew on a stump almost immediately? Then 25 years later, I guess it's about 25 years now, when that stump rots away, the roots are exposed, and it looks like the tree's standing. It looks like it has legs.
Like a spider.
Like a spider, yeah. And eventually, when it gets really big, it can still be seen. Sometimes yellow birch will even do that over big rocks and boulders and stand tall. It's pretty cool.
So you know something was cut there. I mean, white pine usually indicates cutting, usually. So you know there's probably white pine in that area, and that can tell you something about the area.
So theoretically, even 50 to 100 years later, you'd still probably be able to see those characteristics in the butt log of that yellow birch after that stump's long gone.
Yeah. That's pretty neat, right? Hemlock, on the other hand, you know, we've talked about this in other shows, but hemlock bark is used for tannins, right? Which is a preservative. So hemlock bark, sometimes the whole stump will rot away, but the bark will be there, and it'll become a hollow, extremely hollowed out, like only the bark is there. You've seen this in the woods.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, and you can kick it, and it'll just fall over. That's very old, right? So, yeah, that's how you can usually tell hemlock. If you see the bark on it, hemlock, most likely. Because hemlock bark and white pine can kind of look similar as they age. You know, it's hard for me to tell the difference, you know what I mean?
Well, I don't see them often enough to know.
Yeah. So, hardwood stumps. Okay, so there's two types of hardwood stumps. Normally, hardwoods rot uniformly and last about 30 years. All right. So, examples would be sugar maple, red maple, right? Stuff like that. Yellow birch, black birch. Okay. And then there's the rot-resistant hardwoods that screw everything up. Right? And they last a long time. Like black locust.
Yeah. You
know? White oak, black locust, American chestnut. I doubt there's any American chestnut stumps left, but once upon a time there was. And actually, Tom Wessels talks about finding some to this day, but you'd have to have a much better eye than I do to notice that, because most chestnuts are gone. So, all right, so that stilted rooting, you'll get three types of rooting. And you just talked about how, like, you know, the stump will rot away, and it looks like a spider because the stump's gone, and there it is just sitting there. If it's – sometimes a tree is so old that it will grow on an old mound, right? And then the mound actually disintegrates after 300 years or so, and its roots are elevated, and you wonder why. It probably may have grown on an old wind site. So those wind damage there 300 years ago, and now there's a, you know – I don't know. a yellow birch tree growing there.
Right. And some of those could stand waist higher or higher, really, depending on where that root ball stood when it first tipped over.
Yeah. That's pretty crazy. If you see yellow birch or eastern hemlock growing in a circle, but there's nothing in the middle, I've seen this a few times in the woods. Where you'll see yellow birch or hemlock growing in a circle, and their roots are kind of elevated. There was a stump there, and there was a white pine stump, most likely. So again, you can tell there's white pine there at one time. I have seen that before, not knowing what it was. Sometimes you'll see hemlocks or yellow birch, mostly hemlock, I find, and one side's almost flat, and they're in a line. And then if you can trace back, and there'll be a pit or a mound, a tree fell over, windstorm,
laid
probably a white pine, served as a nurse log for a hemlock or yellow birch to grow. And you'll see them growing in a line like that in the woods. That means there was an ancient windstorm there hundreds of years ago.
And so why usually white pine?
The white pine creates that moss, which is a great germination site for yellow birch and hemlock to grow up on.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. So, other evidence of cutting, some are more obvious. I mean, if you see a stump and then there's no log, right?
Right.
It's probably logging, right?
Someone took it out, yep.
Yeah. I mean, you can usually find some kind of remains if it was wind damage with a stump. And it starts to resemble a cut stump because it starts to rot and stuff. But the log will always be there. You'll usually find the top, and you can even find usually kerf marks if you look carefully enough. So, also, you can tell the exact diameter, usually, pretty close, of what trees they were cutting back in the day. So if you see sprouts, you know, red maple sprouts, typically in the Catskills, and they'll grow around the original stump.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's how big the original stump was. And if they're growing really close together, sprouts, it was probably growing around a very small tree. That's usually from fire, according to Wessels, because fire takes out small trees. And no one cuts small trees for timber because they're not worth as much money. So usually if it's a timber harvesting, you'll see stump sprouts growing from larger stumps, right?
So they would be more spread out, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Spread around in a semicircle.
Right. So the red maple I'm thinking of, which I see all the time, there's five or six of them in a very tight clump.
Yeah.
Probably not, that might not have been fire. That could have been animal or something.
Could have been.
But it could have been fire, I guess.
Yeah, it could have been. Could have been. I mean, I'd have to see it, but look at it carefully and try to visualize how they grew originally in mm-hmm. that circle. Maybe that'll tell you something. I don't know. Maybe you guys are doing firewood or something back in the day. It's tough to say. So up next, we'll talk about evidence of fire for the last segment of the show. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Reading the Forested Landscape, and tonight's show is based upon Tom Wessel's book, Reading the Forested Landscape.
Asks you why, you can tell her that I told you that I'm tired of castles in the air. I've got a dream, I want the world to share, and castle walls just lead me to despair. Hills of forest green where the mountains touch the sky, a dream come true. I'll live there till I die. I'm asking you to say my last goodbye. The love we knew ain't worth another try. Save me from all the trouble and the pain. I know I'm weak, but I can't face that girl again. If you tell it to her plain, but how can words express the feel of sunlight in the morning in the hills, away from city strife? I need a country woman for my wife. I'm city born, but I love the country life.
All right, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is Reading the Forested Landscape, based off of Tom Wessel's book, Reading the Forested Landscape. So, evidence of fire, John. There's three things that Mr. Wessel goes into. One is age discontinuity. And I've seen this firsthand after a forest fire, but usually if you're in a forest that's been burned, the larger trees survive just because they're larger and it's harder to kill them and girdle them through the flames, through heat action. So there's large trees. But the middle trees, the younger trees, the pole-sized trees are killed.
And then years later you'll have old trees and then the young trees that regrew after the fire?
Right. So there's a missing age class.
Okay.
Missing pole-sized trees. So that's one thing. Kind of resembles a lot of what those colonists described, didn't they? Where you could ride a horse through the woods in the 1500s, 1600s.
Right.
Yeah, Native Americans probably managing something. So then you get multiple trunk trees is the second thing. And if you see a lot of tight sprouts, trees sprouting really close to each other, they probably sprouted from really small trees because they were growing in a ring around that original tree.
Right.
So in timber harvesting, people don't cut small trees normally. So fire does, though. So there you go. So that's the second thing. And the third thing I think is really cool. I did not know this. There'll be uphill basal scars. So fire typically burns uphill.
So it's hottest on the downhill side of the tree? Is that what you're saying?
No, it's the opposite. Isn't that weird? So get this. Fire is fed with oxygen from the bottom side and burns uphill, right? Okay. But the tree acts like a dam, and litter accumulates on the uphill side, right? So when you go in the woods next time, you'll see a lot of leaf duff and stuff and twigs on the uphill side.
Okay.
And then that acts as fuel source.
which
so
burns.
Oxygen is fueling the fire behind it.
Yeah, it burns on the downhill side, but then it finds that material, that woody material on the upside that's acted like a dam against the tree and burns really hot and kills the cambium on the uphill side. So you can tell which direction the fire came from.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
So the fire would have come from the opposite side of the burned sky.
Yeah.
Wow.
I know it. I didn't know that. Yeah, trees act as what he calls dams. Litter or fuels accumulate on uphill side. Litter burns against the tree and eventually causes a scar. So it's pretty neat, you know? You know, then there's other evidence out there. But I guess he thinks charcoal is not a really good evidence. I've seen it. I think it is. But I don't know, John. Species, he doesn't really go into species too much. But size, shape. If you have a wolf tree, which means, you know, its shape is growing really out, you know, is an old field, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, a wolf tree with maybe a pole stand all around it. It might tell you in the last 50 years it was abandoned versus all those old giant stems, maybe old sugar maple, all dead in the forest. And then you've got 12 to 16-inch trees all around it, maybe small saw timber, ready to harvest saw timber. You could be looking at something that's 100 years or more abandoned.
Yeah. You know what's really cool? This is something you definitely have seen. I've seen it a lot in people's abandoned pastures in Delaware County. Is you can tell a pasture was overgrazed if there's a lot of juniper growing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Why?
The juniper only grows on really terrible sites, I guess. Okay. And I guess the cows don't eat it. And as the hay field is degraded over time, juniper actually gets a competitive advantage over the grasses that are more lush and stuff like that. I've seen that in the middle of the woods, and it'll be persistent too. So even as stuff grows up, you'll see the dead twigs of the juniper because it's like a cedar, red cedar.
Right.
And so it's like a preservative, and you'll see it as dead skeletons underneath the forest canopy. So you know it was an overgrazed pasture at one time.
So what about species that we see in the forest today that could be attributed to some of these abandonments?
Well, you know, we just ran out of time, but yeah, aspen. I'd say the best one, right? Aspen.
Black cherry. We can attribute the beautiful black cherry we pull out of our hills today from some of that Civil War abandonment.
Yep, black cherry and aspen, man. Without farm abandonment, we wouldn't have nearly as many. Well, that's all the time we have on tonight's show, which was Reading the Forested Landscape. Up next is Mostly British with Rick Neblong. Have a good night.
Good night, everyone.
Then the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way. Getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Shining the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their game. In an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town.